From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This week on the program, we've been talking about the epidemic of opioid addiction. And epidemic doesn't seem to overstate the issue here. According to the latest numbers, nearly 2 million Americans either abused or were dependent on opioids. Not street drugs, pills prescribed by their doctors. In 2013, doctors wrote 249 million prescriptions for opioid pain medications. Percocet, Lorotab, Vicodin. The CDC says that's enough prescriptions for every single adult in this country to have a bottle of pills. This week in Salt Lake City, healthcare professionals and educators and policymakers gathered to talk about the epidemic, and we were there yesterday. We recorded a conversation with some of the people on the front lines of the epidemic in Utah. You'll hear that today on the program. The problems for sure, and some ideas to fix them. After the news.
Hi, I'm the Radio West intern, Emily Anderson. I like KUER because of the ways it connects listeners to the community, the nation, and the world. Whether you're a college student, like me, retired, or anywhere in between, KUER is informative and engaging. Would you feel out of the loop without us? Donate at KUER.org to keep your favorite programs available on the air and online. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On Wednesday, the reporter Sam Quinones joined us to talk about America's opioid epidemic. And he explained how we got to this point. 2 million people either abusing or dependent on prescription opioids. And every state is afflicted. Here in Utah, every month, 24 people die from prescription drug overdoses. That's a 400% increase in those kinds of deaths since 2000. In other words, that number has gone up by a factor of five. This week, law enforcement officials and healthcare professionals, along with educators and the loved ones of people who died or are addicted, gathered in Salt Lake City for a summit to talk about this problem. And organizers of the event invited us to conduct one of those panels. Today in the program, we're going to broadcast that conversation. We had with us on the podium Shane Brogan, who's an associate professor of anesthesiology at the University of Utah's School of Medicine. He's also the director of pain medicine at Huntsman Cancer Institute. David Felt was also with us. He retired last year after 8 years as treatment program administrator for the state's Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. And with us also was Jeffrey Bryan. He is a special agent with the Drug Enforcement Agency here in Utah. He's been working in drug law enforcement for some 26 years. We began with the idea from Sam Quinones that part of this problem is cultural. Quinones says we're in a culture of permanent pleasure, which has contaminated the best of America. And I asked the panel if they agreed. We heard first from Dr. Shane Brogan.
Yes, I think there is a cultural phenomenon here where people have been taught to expect instant relief with medications for whatever ailment they may have. The pharmaceutical industry, our hospital administrators, and society in general has been telling us, oh, you must treat pain, you must be aggressive with it. And we, as pain physicians over the years, have been subject to these rules, and we're trying our best to help out. And so a lot of patients, yes, they expect complete pain relief. And it's on also on us to help these patients understand that we can't always do that. But there has been this societal expectation that we can make them all better. And unfortunately, that's not the case.
David Felt, what do you think? Do you think Quinones says excess contaminated the best of America? Are we in an age of excess and instant gratification?
In some ways, that question is way over my head, but I agree generally that I think there is a cultural piece where people are turning to get easy answers. And as you just said, the idea that a pill can fix everything has been something especially that's been, I think, important here in Utah.
Yeah. Jeffrey Bryan, one of the things you've talked about is the importance of accountability. Does that go along with this thing that Quinones is talking about, that we think we can get whatever we want these days?
Sure. I believe that this overreaching societal problem is a cultural thing, but it's individuals that make up that culture. We have this feeling that you can do whatever you want because you're free to do what you want, but there's no accountability for the consequences, and those things aren't considered by the individual. And if everyone were accountable for their actions, then these things would correct themselves.
I'm guessing there may be some sense among Shane Brogan or David Felt that that could be oversimplifying the question a bit. That's a part of this conversation that I want to get to here in a minute. But let me ask you this first. Are you guys all on the same page on all of this? Law enforcement, medical providers, therapists. Do you talk to each other in the right ways? Are you having regular conversations together like you think you should?
This is the first time I've sat with on anything like this. So the general answer would be no. DEA works more closely with physicians because there is a natural relationship there by law. But we don't work a lot with the clinical social work side of it, no.
And is that a problem?
If the law enforcement officer or agency had tools available to them to be able to refer people, that might help. But I don't know if we can become social workers. That's not our role. As you know, there's a lot of things on the table for
you
law enforcement.
You wouldn't have
officers.
To become social workers, but the question is, should you be having more regular conversations with, like, treatment professionals, for example? David Felt, what do you think about that?
I think here in Utah especially, the treatment professions and the law enforcement have generally been working very closely together. The DEA is probably a step above where many of them, but in terms of local law enforcement, the sheriff's office, there have been several programs in terms of where the treatment and probation and patrol, parole are working together. I think that piece is getting better and better. I think an area where we haven't done as well is talking to the doctors, and I think to some degree, I think we're all trying to accomplish the same things, but I think we've been educated very differently. I think doctors have been told it's not addictive. Well, treatment professionals, you know, have known for years that it is, and it's been a very difficult process to have that discussion sometimes just because of confidentiality laws. So I think we could do better in that.
Shane Brogan, what about you?
Yeah, if I may, I could relate an experience I had a number of years ago when we had some very nice DEA agents who came to our clinic, and they hung out with us for the day, and they saw how we worked with our patients and how we approached opioid management in general with our patients. And it was good for them. It was great for us because we got to sort of hear their perspective on what their thoughts on this issue are. But at the end of the day, they came to us and said, "You do a good job. We have these misconceptions about what pain docs do, but here we are in this clinic, and we see that you have a very rigorous thought process over how we prescribe opioids, and more importantly, when we don't prescribe." So it was a very useful experience. Should we be doing it more? Absolutely. I think this is something that we could be doing more, and we should be doing it on a regular basis. But we don't really have a forum for that at the moment.
I wonder if you all agree on the basic question of how we got to this point. Quinones explains that in his book, how this pain revolution comes about in the 90s, where doctors start, as opposed to being terrified about prescribing narcotics for pain relief, start thinking differently. And palliative care, Quinones talks about, was guided by these moral issues of patient autonomy and respect for the individual and for differences. It was idealistic. It was good. But then the idea is that the pendulum swung to the point where it's now kind of out of control, and you have doctors prescribing opioids for wisdom teeth extractions and carpal tunnel syndrome and bad knees and chronic back pain and root canals and headaches and arthritis. Do you agree that's essentially where we are now?
I think we are mostly on the same page, and I think you summarized it well. There was a phobia of giving opioids for anything until relatively recently, and then through some very well-meaning initiatives, opioids became more available, more promoted, and for some patients, this was absolutely the right thing to do. For some patients, it didn't work out, and then for some patients, it was a death sentence. And we're trying to figure all that out. So the pendulum did swing. I think it hasn't swung back, but I think it's maybe stopped. And there's certainly a lot more thought about this whole epidemic, both of where of the opioid epidemic, but also that pain epidemic. And I guess my reason for being here is to represent those patients who perhaps do benefit from opioids, and so they don't get left out of this discussion.
Agent Brian, has it made your life more difficult that doctors are prescribing opioids for carpal tunnel syndrome and wisdom tooth extraction?
Well, I don't think you can group all the doctors in the same category.
Right.
I think the vast majority of physicians are doing a phenomenal job. Unfortunately, there are many who, for various reasons, whether it's they really feel like they are helping this individual by prescribing more and more narcotics, or, to be honest and frank, there are some physicians out there that are in it for the money because they can get these patients in and out quick. They're charging $150 for the visit. They're writing a script, and they're out the door. There are doctors here in Utah who are prescribing, can you imagine, 900 oxycodone 30 milligram tablets per month. That's 30 tablets per day per patient. Now, do you think that's excessive? Who wouldn't think it's excessive? But who are we as law enforcement to say that's excessive? I know it's excessive because I was...
What do you mean, who are we as law enforcement? Can't you say that that's excessive from a law enforcement perspective?
Well, from a law enforcement perspective, I can, because I was buying the residual pills on the street from those individuals. Okay, so I know that they were doing it to make money. But the courts have a hard time saying, no, you can't do that, because there is no limit. There's no number that says, okay, this is how many you can prescribe.
That'll get us to this question of whether there should be a law. We'll come back to that. David Feld, I want to get you on that point, though, that we were talking about. Do you see it? How's the pendulum swung from your perspective? And is that making your life, I guess before you retired, maybe you're still thinking about it these days, for treatment professionals in general, is it making their lives more difficult to having to deal with the excess?
Having been in the field and as a therapist and supervising and working with programs, I've seen an incredible increase. And I think the thing that gets very frustrating at the treatment field is when you have a client or a patient that goes to the doctor and says, look, I have an addiction problem. I have this procedure coming up. I want to minimize it. And the doctor says, oh, don't worry about it, and prescribes a huge amount of opiates, even in cases where it would be questionable. And like has been pointed out, we can't counter the doctor's orders because we don't have that authority. But it shows a real lack of understanding of addiction and of the ability of the opiates to bring a relapse into the disease. And so I think that's been the frustrating piece, and that ties back to, I think, we're trying for the same thing, but we've been sort of educated in different ways. And I think the pendulum has swung. I think hopefully we're starting to swing it back. The fact that there are medical folks at this conference, I think, is a huge step forward.
Shane Brogan, I want to talk to you about what we think we understand about pain. Like, what is pain? Because something you've talked about is that it's not easy to measure. It's not like blood pressure. And I wanted to read something from the Institute of Medicine. Because pain cannot be seen or measured objectively or interpreted within the context of the known, it's more likely to be dismissed, diminished, or avoided. The irony is that this pain and suffering, just like that of the patient with a known disease, could be dominating their lives. It's a disease in its own right. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I agree with it. You know, and it's an incredibly difficult condition to treat. That's why I do it. That's why it's a specialty of medicine now. And I struggle with it, and I'm formally trained in it. And you know, just to get back what Jeff was saying, I completely agree. There are some bad actor doctors out there who are doing terrible things. But the vast majority of docs are who are prescribing opioid medications and trying to treat pain as best as they can are primary care physicians who simply don't have time to deal with such a complex issue. Mm-hmm. They already have to deal with the blood pressure problems and the cholesterol and all their other issues. But then pain comes up, and it's so much easier just to prescribe for that. It's so much more difficult and so much more time-consuming to sit down and have a conversation and thoughtfully come up with a treatment plan and identify patients who perhaps aren't good candidates for opioid therapy. So that's where I see the great problem in my profession. I agree with that statement that it is a very complex problem. We don't have a way to measure it. So you can't disprove that someone has pain. You have to take their word for it. We have all sorts of pain scores, but again, that's the patient's, you have to take their word for it. In my practice, I treat mostly cancer pain, so I can look at their CT scan and say, oh my goodness, that must really hurt.
Yeah.
But for a lot of primary care doctors, they don't have that luxury of having a firm diagnosis to treat. So yes, there are lots of patients who have genuine pain. What we have learned over the decades is it's not a one-size-fits-all approach to treatment of prescribe an opioid and hope for the best. It has to be an interdisciplinary approach to pain management with using different modalities, including physical therapy, sometimes medications, non-opioid medications, acupuncture, and really just sort of stepping back and looking at the big picture, looking at the patient's other health conditions. We also know that there's a big overlap between pain and mood disorders like mm-hmm. depression. So it's...
So it's emotional pain sometimes that they think they need a pill for?
Sometimes some patients have major depression
yep.
or anxiety disorder. If you're depressed, you'll feel your pain more, for example. And sometimes the answer is not dealing with the pain directly, but also addressing the mental health problems, which is also brings up another big deficiency in our healthcare system.
David Felt, what do you have to say about
well,
that?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I absolutely agree that most of the doctors are very well-intentioned. And one of the things that's been really, really important is the development of really reputable quality pain treatment centers to where a clinic can send somebody to that and have the reliable knowledge that they're not just going to be doing opiates because that's the easiest thing to do. The other piece is that substance use disorder treatment programs are not very well equipped to treat pain, and very often our therapists need to be trained more about what pain and some alternatives are. And so there's been gaps on both sides because very often I think a patient with coming in reporting pain, it's going to be looked at as an excuse or some other reason and not really treated as the issue it can be. So I think there's efforts and continued communication needed on both sides.
You say treated as a medical condition.
I think addiction needs to be treated as a medical condition. For far too long, we've talked about it being a disease, but we've treated it on an acute care basis. We haven't really treated it as we do other chronic conditions. I think the fact that if you really look at how we even talk about people with substance use disorders, we call them addicts, we call them alcoholics, and we need to take it out of the shadows and talk about these as problems that anybody can have. Anybody can become addicted to the substances. Yes, there's a genetic predisposition, there's a behavioral component, but there's no one clear path and nobody that's automatically protected from it. And I think the more we start talking about it and treating on a continuum of care, instead of just a short-term treatment, at which point we sort of go, well, you're done with treatment, you must be cured now. It's a chronic illness, like diabetes.
Adrian Bryan, I wondered, I'm guessing you agree in principle with the idea that addiction should be treated as a medical condition, but I wonder, by the same token, if you worry that that makes it more difficult to hold people accountable.
Yeah. I do agree with that. That's a again, I don't think you can lump everybody in the same category. There are individuals who are healthy and are riding their bike and get hit by a car and have back problems and are prescribed an opiate and they became addicted as a result of that prescription. And it was not a conscious decision on their part at all. They are now an addict. They're addicted to the drug. And if we're going to bring it out of the shadows, let's call it what it is. They're addicted to the drug. And I deal with the people who will do anything to get that drug. And laws don't matter. They'll do anything to get that drug if they have to. Now, we have a whole other group of people who aren't in that category. We have a very large segment of our population who choose to do that. That's a conscious decision on their part to start using marijuana, for example. Today, in our society, that is not a negative thing, to use marijuana. I've got news for you. This is one of the main reasons we're in this dilemma now. Because marijuana users, it's a gateway drug, and that's the truth. So,
can I push back on that?
Yeah.
It's pretty controversial these days to say that marijuana is a gateway drug, but I'm sure you can back that up.
Walk a week in my shoes.
Okay. So the question is, so a lot of people are saying if you have people who are trying to numb their pain. Some would say, let's go to something that won't, if you overuse it, won't actually stop their breathing and kill them. And marijuana is that. And so let's legalize marijuana.
That's debatable.
Okay, fine. But that's the biggest question is, I think people are saying, what if we legalized some drugs like marijuana, which is, you know, is happening in some states across this country. Your idea, then, is that that's not going to help. So I want to hear you on that point,
oh,
and all of you on that point of legalizing.
We only have an hour and a half.
I know this is me. You say no, but let's hear your case, and I want to hear the others on that.
Should we legalize marijuana? Is oxycodone legal?
No.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, I guess that's right. Of course it is. That's the problem. That's right.
And look where we're at. I have done this for 26 years, and when we arrest someone, we always attempt to interview them. And we interview hundreds of other people that we don't arrest because their involvement or, you know, we're getting information from them. And one of the things that I always ask is, how did you get started in this? And I'm not exaggerating. 99 out of 100 will tell me, I started using marijuana. That was the downfall because it alters their mind. It alters their mind, and it puts them in a different place where decisions are not rational anymore. It starts them on a path of different friends, different environments, and all those things combined then lead them to, well, it's just a pill.
Shane Brogan, what do you say?
Yeah, I really don't see a huge cause and effect. I mean, the science is, I think, is not clear on this, whether marijuana is a gateway drug or not. As I see it, and I think you referred to this, there's a certain percentage of the population that has an addictive personality or predisposition, genetics, whatever you want to call it. And I don't really think it matters what it's going to be. It could be tobacco, it could be alcohol, it could be marijuana. It'll basically be whatever is easiest to get.
David Felt, you want to weigh in?
A couple of things. First of all, I do not support legalization of marijuana, primarily because of the more we make it available, the more it's available to adolescents. And marijuana, when it's being used by adolescents, very much like alcohol, greatly affects the brain development. And I think that's a real critical time. It's available. I'd like to see the availability of it reduced, but I would hate to see it legal and become more available. I would kind of want to go back to one point very quickly. There's a difference between drug use and addiction. Many, many people drink alcohol, but very, very few people become addicted to the alcohol and have the brain changes that go with it. And so I think sometimes we confuse just drug use with addiction, and they're very separate things.
That's David Felt, who retired last year from Utah's Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. We also heard from Shane Brogan, Director of Pain Medicine at Huntsman Cancer Institute, and Jeffrey Bryan, who was a DEA special agent here in Utah. We recorded the conversation as part of the Utah Heroin and Opioid Summit in Salt Lake City. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're following up on a conversation we had on Wednesday. The reporter Sam Quinones joined us to talk about the origins of the opioid addiction epidemic in this country. And he explained the factors at play that brought us to this point. But we also wanted to hear from some of the people on the front line of this epidemic. There was this gathering of law enforcement officials and healthcare workers and others in Salt Lake City this week. It was the Utah Heroin and Opioid Summit. And organizers asked us to be a part of one of the panels, so we're broadcasting that conversation today. We had with us the DEA agent Jeffrey Bryan. We had David Felt with us, who was recently retired from the State Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. And Shane Brogan was with us, Director of Pain Medicine at Huntsman Cancer Institute. We'll hear from Dr. Brogan first in this part of the program. I asked how you find a balance between treating chronic pain on one hand and coping with addiction and excess on the other.
It's a huge, huge issue and very complicated, but it's surmountable, in my opinion. For me, I think it comes down to mostly education, education of the public, getting away from that one pill can fix everything concept. It's education of physicians, education of hospital administrators, education of insurance companies, for example, promoting or requiring insurance companies to pay for interdisciplinary pain programs. Most insurance companies have no problems paying for these medications we're writing. However, they have great difficulty with paying for comprehensive pain treatment programs that include admittedly more expensive upfront costs like physical therapy and pain psychology and so on, but also recognizing the overlap between the propensity for substance abuse and pain medicine, and also funding comprehensive substance abuse programs, which is also a big, big issue in this state, in this country.
Do you think a doctor should be writing an opioid for wisdom teeth extraction? What if you just said, let's not do that anymore? Like, chronic pain in certain circumstances, you go through the process, we get to know the patient, we understand the real issues here, and we come to a real conclusion that in these cases, absolutely, an opioid is appropriate. But for an 18-year-old kid who just got his wisdom teeth out, no. Is that oversimplifying it?
I should point out that the U.S. is quite unique in this regard. Most countries in the world, absolutely you will not get a opioid medicine after your wisdom tooth extraction. I hesitate to say yes or no, it's the right thing. In my sort of biased opinion, I actually think it's a dangerous practice and it gets to that whole supply side of where these medicines are coming from.
Then why not outlaw it? Why not outlaw it? Say, nope, we can't. For carpal tunnel syndrome, nope. For bad knees, nope. Why can't we just identify the certain things and say, no, that doesn't rise to the level of prescribing a narcotic?
Yeah, I think then you get into lots of issues of unintended consequences. I don't favor making these black and white rules. I would prefer to educate doctors or dentists or podiatrists or whoever's giving out these medicines on what's appropriate, what's not.
But they're abusing it. Some are. The bad actors are.
Yes, a minority. So I absolutely favor more scrutiny of that, and I don't think you can legislate it, but I think it, again, comes down to giving the respecting that patient-physician relationship and our autonomy to do the right thing. So if, let's say, a dentist does a particularly aggressive procedure and the patient last time had issues, yes, the dentist should have the right to prescribe appropriately.
So don't take it away.
Don't take it away, but look at it closely and think about, is it necessary? And is it necessary to give 90 pills, or should I just give 5 pills?
Yeah.
Or should I just wait and see how they do, if they want to call me tomorrow and report in? So, again, it gets back to that thing of we want to be compassionate, we want to care for our patients, but let's not forget that pain doesn't kill people. You know, pain pills can.
Yeah. Adrian, Brian, what do you think about that?
Well, I don't think the problem is the wisdom teeth extraction.
Really?
No. If a dentist is prescribing, an oral surgeon is prescribing oxycodone to a teenager, an 18-year-old who just got their wisdom teeth out, he may prescribe 5 5-milligram tablets. They're not going to get addicted to that. That's going to get them through the first 2 days of pain, and then they're going to be on ibuprofen. And most of us have had our wisdom teeth out, and we know that's a miserable 2 days, and that'll help you get through it. But those 5 pills aren't the problem that we're talking about. It's when doctors are prescribing 180 and more pills that are hitting the streets. That's the problem. So
they're prescribing 180 for what conditions?
For chronic back pain,
yep,
knee pain, things like that. So
under that line of reasoning, legislation necessarily wouldn't help. Or do you think it would?
Well, I don't think that we can tell a dentist that he can't prescribe a narcotic for that. That's an individual basis, depending on the patient and the doctor and their relationship and the need. And only the doctor will know. They're smart. That's why they go to school for 100 years. They're smart, and they know. And so I don't think we could take that away from them, no.
What do you think?
I absolutely agree that I don't think you can put legislative limits on it. The Department of Health published prescription guidelines in 2009. They're revising them as we speak. They're going to be coming out. I think those guidelines, which can then be used as tools to educate, because I agree education really is the key for physicians at all levels. I just don't think you can arbitrarily take that ability of a doctor to treat a patient on a person-to-person basis away.
The CDC has some guidelines. Opioids should not be the first choice. You should establish realistic goals with the patient. You should use the lowest effective dose, prescribe short durations for acute pain, evaluate the benefits and the harms often. I'm guessing you're all in agreement with those basic guidelines?
Absolutely. The CDC guidelines you mentioned are very well thought out. And really, I think if prescribers adhere to the guidelines in there universally, I think we could really, really stem the tide on this and swing the pendulum the other way, yet still provide care to the patients who actually do require opioid therapy.
So what's the problem?
Silence.
Sounds like you guys are in agreement. People are acting responsibly. These guidelines make a lot of sense.
Well, not everyone, though. Not everyone does act responsibly.
Okay.
I think there's a big difference between physicians who prescribe for the pain, but they're not trying to treat the symptom. They're trying to treat the cause. So they may prescribe for the pain in the moment, but let's find the root problem of this pain. Is it something that can be, is it a knee problem that can be corrected? Is it some other problem that can be corrected through therapy or yoga or whatever else? Are they trying to treat the problem and not just the symptom of pain? And the cases that I'm seeing of those bad actor doctors, there is no mention of what are we going to do to make you better. It's all about the pain and just treating that pain.
And Jeffrey Brown, why is that then? I mean, one of the things that Sam Quinones talks about is managed care is one of the things, competition between doctors, for example. It's complicated, obviously goes through some of this in his book. Basically, he says doctors started to use their prescription pads to keep their patients healthy and to keep their patient visits short. Is that part of the problem?
I think the true bad actors are a true outlier, and they're not even practicing medicine anymore. They're a disgrace, and that's where we need your help to shut these petitioners down. But from a medical professional standpoint, you know, we need our medical state boards to do a better job about policing this, provide more education, you know, from medical school through residency, through whatever subsequent training physicians do, as well as ongoing education in the safe use of opioids. In my experience in the last 4 or 5 years, I think the general level of education is improved. The Utah State Initiative, Use Only as Directed, is a good example of an educational endeavor that was quite successful. So we need, you know, continuing funding for that and more.
I will say this, one thing that we've kind of not talked about with these doctors, another element that they have to deal with is being tricked. Drug seekers are very manipulative. Ask any parent who has a child, an adult child, or adolescent child who is using drugs. They're very manipulative. And they're the same way in the doctor's office, and they can put on a pretty good show and be very convincing, and they can trick or fool these doctors, too, into thinking that they really do need this drug. So that's a whole other, you know, how do you train the doctors to watch out for that?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm glad you brought up that. And he's right. These patients who are drug-seeking are very, very clever. And I've been fooled. We've all been fooled. But we do have tools to prevent that from happening. With the Utah State Controlled Substance Database, that's a great resource that not every state has. But I can access the prescription patterns of my patients really easily online. So it should be, you know, mandatory that our patients do that. Those CDC guidelines that we mentioned earlier, that does address that issue. But these patients who have a real addiction problem, they get very creative. We cannot, no way, mandate a number of pills or a milligrams per day. That was tried in Washington State, hasn't worked out. There's always ways around that. It just potentially has unintended consequences with the under-treatment of pain in selected patients. And it's really never going to be as simple as finding an arbitrary number of pills or milligrams per day. So any legislative efforts, in my opinion, should be, number one, to help get the rogue docs who are doing this. I've reported rogue docs, and they've got, you know, their license has been revoked in Utah, but then I hear they've moved to Idaho, for example. You know, this happens, so we need to make it easier for us to get at the bad actors. But more importantly, and this is the vast majority of providers, is just educate, and pay for that education at a legislative level.
You all talked about the importance of kind of taking a holistic approach to the way you manage pain. What is a holistic approach look like? It sounds expensive, but how do you do it?
Part of it is, I think, treatment programs need to take into account client pain and then work with physicians and work with pain clinics to recognize that. One of the things I've seen, and I know that long-term use of opioids actually increases pain sensitivity. So one of the things that clients have to go through is this problem of no matter what happens, they're going to be more sensitive and feel more pain. That's a natural process and takes time to get rid of. But I think part of it is needs to be a continued ongoing dialogue between the medical field and the substance use disorder treatment field, or the folks that are treating the physical pain. And one of the things I wanted to mention, along with the education, I think one of the barriers to that currently continues to be the confidentiality regulations for substance use disorder clinics, which is 42 CFR. The local legislature can't deal with that, but I think we need to take a look at maybe those regulations have exceeded their usefulness, and we need to go to HIPAA, which will make right now it can be very difficult for a treatment program to talk to a physician and vice versa. And I think we need to erase those barriers.
Anything else in that line that you wanted to mention?
I think, Doug, you mentioned that holistic sounds expensive, and yes, it is, but at the same time, that Institute of Medicine report quoted that chronic pain costs the U.S. economy $600 billion a year. So that's the potential saving. No, we're not going to get all of these patients better, but if we treat them in a holistic manner from the outset, there are so many downstream savings to be had. Prescription medicine costs, emergency room visits for pain, unnecessary surgeries for pain, unnecessary MRI scans, for example. So there are huge savings that are hard to quantify but very real. And when we say holistic, again, there's no one-size-fits-all. Yoga is not going to work for everyone, but if it works for you, great. And if it helps you not be on pain medicines, that's wonderful. Sometimes, yes, a selected medication may help you, and that's the only thing that works. Other times, it's physical therapy. The important thing is just to realize that we have a huge toolkit at our disposal and not just use a hammer. And, yes, good doctoring is hard to define, but how I define it is just being able to sit with your patient and talk about it and figure out what's going to work for them. It's a lot easier to write a prescription than to do that, but unfortunately we don't get paid for time. We get paid to do procedures, we get paid to move through clinic quickly, and there's a lot of productivity demands, so we aren't always compensated for our time. And that's one of the big problems.
Yeah. One of the things, Agent Brian, you've talked about is somehow going after distributors, not users, like trying to break the distribution cycle. Wanted to hear your thoughts on that. Because one of the issues that Sam Quinones has written about, and I know that you all probably agree, is problematic are these marketing techniques that have developed over the years that Sam Quinones writes about, direct selling and direct advertising, doctors directly promoting drugs. And maybe we're past the days of free samples and free coupons for opioids. I'm guessing we are. But is that still an issue or a problem we need to address or talk about? Jeffrey, Brian?
Well, there's a difference between civil actions against a doctor and criminal actions against a doctor. And in my world, we're trying to find the drug distributors.
Yeah.
And so, and they come in every shape and form. And ultimately, maybe it leads to a doctor who is overprescribing for the wrong purposes just to make money. Okay? Very few, but it happens. Now, I would want to go after them criminally because they are the Pablo Escobar of oxycodone in Salt Lake City, right? But remember, in criminal law, to be found guilty, it has to be beyond a reasonable doubt. So it turns out to be a battle between expert witnesses. And you can have all the evidence put forth, and we show that the patient goes in and 1 minute and 45 seconds later, they walk out with a prescription for 180 oxycodone 30s. They go directly to the pharmacy, and they sell it to one of us on the street. So it happens that quickly. But when it comes to the courtroom, and we can put all that evidence out there, but when it comes to the courtroom, and you have one expert saying, that's ridiculous, nobody should be prescribing that much and that often without doing any physical examination, and then there's another expert witness who's being paid to say, you can't say that because that doctor is trained and he knows what he's doing and everything is legitimate. You see how easily doubt creeps into a jury's mind? So it becomes extremely difficult to bring a case against the Pablo Escobar of a community to court, because it's so easy to have doubt creep up in that case. Now, the individuals who are getting those drugs and selling them on the streets, that's easy, because it's easy to show their criminal intent. But it's not so easy for those few doctors. And those few doctors, unfortunately, put a lot of drugs on the street. So it's very complicated. It's extremely difficult.
David Felder, Shane Brogan, you want to talk about that?
Well, I just want to say I'm glad I know what you look like now, Jeff. So when you come to my clinic, I'll examine your back well, but I will not give you any medication. But no, this is a horrible problem, and it comes back to that thing: if you can't disprove that someone has pain, and you have to take their word for it, and that has been manipulated now by these bad actors and flooding the streets with opioids, and it's just astonishing to me how easy it is. Our medical boards need to do a better job with policing our docs, and if it's well-intended misadventure where docs think they're doing the right thing but not adhering to accepted standards, then we need to help educate those doctors and rein them in. But if it's truly negligent or even criminal behavior, obviously it should be zero tolerance for that, and these docs should not be allowed to practice.
And the people that I've seen in our system sees are not the distributors. They're the people you've arrested that have just, you know, gotten a prescription. They're the victims very often. So that's who we see. And so I wish you could do more and had it easier.
You don't know how many parents, after we arrest their child, say, "Can't you just please keep them in jail? Because it's the only place that they're clean, and I know that they're safe. Can you please keep them in jail?" And we just can't. The jail system is not built for that. And so it's a real dilemma.
That's Jeffrey Bryan. He's a DEA special agent here in Utah. Shane Brogan also joined us yesterday. He's director of pain medicine at Huntsman Cancer Institute. We also had with us David Felt, who retired last year from the State Division of Substance Abuse and Mental Health. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We should thank the organizers of the Utah Heroin and Opioid Summit held this week in Salt Lake City. Thanks in particular to Jennifer Gooley of the U.S. Attorney's Office. Thanks also to Zach Kregel and Dirk Hooley, who provided audio services. The show was mixed by our engineer, Lewis Downey. Emily Anderson is our intern. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.